This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In ancient times, cities glittered like diamonds on the coast, all seen by our eyes in space before we fell from the heat of our own energy. I crossed the globe in a single day, ate fresh fruit from the other side of the world. I wore clothes made from the homes of dying apes and never saw it coming for me. Larger than any tale told, darker than the oldest curse, oozing invisible from the dead sunlight, melting roots long far away, came the dawn of our surrender. I cried, and then I danced, into the night. Are you anxious? Did you feel a sense of dread about the way things were going, even before the coronavirus pandemic? Our guest, Margaret Klein Salomon, is a clinical psychologist turned climate warrior. 5 years ago, when Margaret claimed a climate emergency and called for mass mobilization, she was called alarmist and extreme. Now cities and countries all over the world have called for a climate emergency. Margaret has written a new book about how to overcome eco-anxiety. That sounds timely. With all things corona overwhelming our lives and the news, greenhouse gas emissions have not stopped, by the way, and climate change continues to drive more vicious events, including fires, floods, extreme storms, drought, and soon extreme heat in the Northern Hemisphere. Forget about what will happen by the year 2100. New science shows large ocean systems will begin to die off during this decade, with land ecology collapsing a decade or two later. It is chilling news we need to know now. Dr. Alex Pigott joins us from London to explain this major paper published in the journal Nature. Following our guests, I have a few observations about how we are being totally misled about opening the economy anytime soon, and what that means for our lives. Forget that forced optimism, that desperate need to make more money. We need to concentrate on just a couple of things here. Keeping people alive until help comes, as a vaccine or a treatment, and using this great pause to kickstart a new economy to survive that other emergency, climate change and the era of mass extinction. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go to our first guest. People ask what will happen after this pandemic, and the answer is the next emergency is already developing on us. Many species alive on Earth will collapse due to climate change, and it could be much sooner than we thought. That is the next great emergency. According to new science, if we go back to normal business, masses of species are going to die together, abruptly, possibly starting even within this decade. But we can still flatten that curve and give those animals, plants, and other works of nature several more decades so we don't overload ecological systems with mass deaths. That's all in a striking new paper published this April in the leading journal Nature. And despite the current health emergency, you need to hear this news. These scientists warn potentially catastrophic loss of global biodiversity is on the horizon. One of the three authors is Dr. Alex L. Pigott. He is a postdoctoral research scientist in the Center for Biodiversity and Environment Research, located at the University College London. Dr. Pigott has co-authored at least 33 papers and specializes in the distribution of living things on this planet. He joins us now from England. Alex Pigott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, biodiversity has never been a sexy must-know topic for the broad public, but to be real, can human civilization expect to survive without that broad range of other species on the planet with us?
Well, I think it has been a sexy topic, and the answer to your question is, I believe, no. I think that we're increasingly understanding how human society is inextricably dependent on the ecosystems of which we are a part, and we can't be separated from that.
As we speak, Alex, the world's big coral nursery, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, continues to die off even more widely than before, Could that be an early signal of the more serious die-offs projected in your paper?
Yes, I think so. So, you know, what we've seen in the Great Barrier Reef over the last 3 years are these three major mass bleaching events. These aren't localized events. These are very widespread and are being caused when we get these temporary excursions of the temperature to these much hotter conditions than the corals in that region are adapted to. And I think this is a potential precursor for the kinds of continuous and chronic impacts that we're projecting in our study.
And if emissions continue to increase as they were, how soon could ocean systems collapse?
So our models are suggesting that these impacts could start as early as the current decade. These are really concerns that we should have for the present day. Often when we think about climate change, we might think about, oh, well, we're worried about the world that our children may inherit. But actually, I think what our results are showing is that these major impacts of climate change are potentially going to start very soon indeed.
Alex, why didn't other scientific projections pick up how soon natural systems could enter a stage of die-off?
So there's been a lot of work on trying to understand what the world might look like in terms of biodiversity in the future. But a lot of the time when we're making these sorts of projections, we often use a single snapshot of the future. So that might be the year 2050 or 2070 or even 2100, which are these dates that are quite remote in the future. What we did in our study was that we actually broke down those projections at these annual time slices. So we could actually look at how the risk from climate change to biodiversity would accumulate in a more continuous way.
And your work suggests we may not lose a steady trickle of species as the climate warms year by year in a regular way. Instead, living systems could hit a brick wall where whole webs collapse together. How would you describe that, Alex?
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, this has been a big unknown in ecology is, again, in addition to when these events might happen, are these events going to accumulate gradually, or could we see the sudden collapse of ecosystems as a result of climate change? And our results are pointing towards the possibility that actually these abrupt disruptions of ecosystems may be more likely than a gradual loss of species. And the reason we find that in our models is that the way that we've quantified this risk of ecological disruption is to take a set of species living at a particular place on the Earth's surface and to ask what's the maximum temperature that each of those species has been exposed to over recent history. And then we ask, well, when in the future will the temperature in that location continuously exceed those upper thermal limits? And what we find is that actually many species living in a location tend to have similar bounds on the kinds of temperatures they've experienced. And as a result, when you move into the future, those bounds are exceeded almost simultaneously.
This reminds me a bit of the spread of COVID-19, which shows up as a few cases and then a cluster and then a steep rise like an explosion of cases. In a similar way, we might tolerate the loss of a few species here and there. We are already tolerating that, not realizing in the future that signal could be a whole system about to crash. It's going to be difficult to get people and governments to get serious about this before it happens. Alex, what do you think?
So I think there's an interesting parallel here between the current crisis we're seeing and also the looming climate crisis. There's an important difference, right? The mechanisms driving these potentially abrupt changes are very different. But I think the point that we really need to act early if we're going to avert these crises in the future. By the time that things start to become bad in your local area, it's probably going to be too late already. We've already hit that wall. So I think the results that our study is showing is that, you know, by the time you start seeing species going extinct in your local area, then really it's going to be too late to act. We're really at the start of this curve now in terms of climate change. We're already starting to see these really catastrophic impacts in places like the Great Barrier Reef that you mentioned, but also more widespread. But we're still at the start of this curve. We still do have the capacity to avert these risks, but we have to act now. We can't wait until those impacts are already upon us.
Well, we talked about the oceans, but if civilization returns to our former rate of emissions, the business-as-usual scenario labeled as RCP 8.5 by the United Nations, When might we see widespread collapse of living things on land where we are, according to your research?
Four results suggest that the impacts of climate change on biodiversity are likely to manifest themselves earliest in the oceans. And the reason for this, and in particular the tropical oceans, and the reason for this is that in these regions, temperature is actually relatively stable. You don't get these wild fluctuations in temperature like you find at high latitudes. So the species that live in the oceans and the tropics tend to be adapted to a very narrow range of conditions, even though actually the rate of warming in the tropical oceans is much lower than the rate of warming at high latitudes on land. It's the species in the tropical oceans that are likely to be exposed to these potentially dangerous conditions first. And that's something that we project could start to happen this decade. And then in terms of when the impacts spread onto land, that's something that could happen in the next couple of decades. So in the 2040s, moving to the mid of the century, that's when we start to see tropical forests also being exposed to these dangerous conditions. And then depending on the emission scenario that we follow, those risks of abrupt ecological disruption can then also spread to higher latitudes. There's one, I think, important clarification to make here about our emissions pathway. So we looked at a range of different emissions scenarios. So these are essentially scenarios of how human emissions might change over this coming century. And then based on those different emission scenarios, we then make these projections of potential biodiversity loss. It's been suggested recently that this idea of business as usual is unrealistic because many countries have already made pledges to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So why look at this business as usual scenario if it's potentially an unlikely path that we'll follow? And I think an important point to make here is that we're looking at an emissions pathway that could be caused, as it is currently, being primarily driven by human emissions. But if we get potential feedbacks in the climate system, such as, for example, the collapse of the Amazon rainforest, which would then release huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, then actually this could then further drive emissions upwards. So I think it's an important point to make that these very high emission scenarios, where we on average across the globe see more than 4 degrees warming, is still something that's very much on the cards unless we drastically reduce our emissions now.
Yes, we're very nervously watching permafrost melt here in Canada and also in Russia. Now, in addition to the when whole webs of living things could fail, you also provide a handy YouTube video showing where the greatest devastation of species is likely to happen. And you show graphics of the Eastern Pacific with some of the greatest losses around Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and the Philippines. One thing I didn't understand, it looked to me like one chart showed the worst case 100% species loss in some places. Surely I'm reading that incorrectly. What does that 100% level mean?
So that is actually what we found. So we found that of all the species that we looked at in that location, and bearing in mind across our entire analysis, we looked at over 30,000 species. What our projections show is that all of the species that currently live in that location will, at some point in the future, which we estimate in our study, be exposed to temperatures that are hotter than anything those species have previously experienced across their entire geographic distribution. And I think an important point to make here is, well, what does it mean when we're projecting exposure to these novel temperatures? And I think the best way to summarize this is essentially species in the future, over the coming decades, will be exposed to temperatures beyond which we have any evidence that those species can survive in the wild. It doesn't necessarily mean that when a species is exposed to these dangerous conditions, it is definitely going to immediately become extinct. Some species may be able to adapt. Some species may, although we don't currently know this, have a tolerance to potentially higher conditions, but we essentially don't have any evidence for this. So what we're really documenting here and trying to understand is when in the future will we pass this threshold where essentially biodiversity is stepping into the unknown? We don't have any evidence that it can actually survive at these higher temperatures. And I think an important point to make here is that actually what we're currently seeing in places like the Great Barrier Reef is suggesting that actually species are living very close to their thermal limits. And as we start to transgress those limits, population declines and extinctions are likely to follow for many species.
K. Can my many listeners in the northern latitudes feel comfortable that a crash of species in the tropics won't affect us very much?
Unfortunately, no. And I think there's, again, two points I'd want to make here. The first is that we project that the impacts of climate change are truly global. There aren't any ecosystems on the planet which won't be affected by climate change. We find that actually the most sensitive species live in the tropics. But there's also very good reasons to expect that actually the impacts that we're documenting at high latitudes could be underestimated. For example, we're just looking at when the average temperature over the course of an entire year shifts beyond that range of temperatures that a species has experienced. We're not, for example, looking at the loss of sea ice, which we know is an important habitat for species at high latitudes. We're not, for example, looking at when a species of plant on which another animal might depend is going to become extinct. And I think if you start building in all these other factors and all these possible chains of reactions between species and these ecosystems, then the impacts could be even more severe than we're projecting. And I think the other reason why we should be concerned, even if we're not living in those ecosystems that are at higher risk, is because actually all of these ecosystems form part of the biosphere. And an impact in one region will have an impact in another. So, for example, one of the regions that we highlight as being particularly sensitive is the Amazon rainforest. We focused on the animals in this study rather than the plants. But what we project is that over the course of the century, many of those species are going to be at risk of extinction. And that's really problematic for the functioning of the forest. We know, for example, that many of the birds and primates in these forests are fundamental in dispersing the seeds of trees. And that's the way that the forest regenerates. That's the way that new trees grow and then lock up the carbon. So if we start to see the loss of these animal communities, we'd also expect similar loss of the plant species in this region, which would then be impacting on things like the storage of carbon, which, as I've already mentioned, could then push temperatures further up. So all these systems are interrelated. We need to be concerned about all of them.
When it comes to the possible collapse of species, what is the difference between warming 2 degrees C by 2100 and more than 4 degrees C by the end of the century?
We found an enormous difference when you start comparing those kinds of scenarios. So we cut this up in two different ways, and these give you quite different angles in which you can look at biodiversity. So one perspective is to ask how many species are going to be impacted by these changes. And what we see is you move from, say, a 4-degree scenario, which is if we continue with our current high emissions, to shifting that to below 2 degrees, then you see around a 60% reduction in the number of species that are exposed to these dangerous climate conditions. The other way you can look at it is to ask not how many species are going to be exposed, but what percentage of the planet, in terms of its area, is at risk. And what we find is that at 4 degrees centigrade of warming on average across the planet, approximately 15% of the world's ecosystems are at high risk for these very abrupt and sudden losses of biodiversity. As you then shift the increase in temperature down to below 2 degrees centigrade, you actually limit that risk to below 2% of the world's surface. It's worth bearing in mind that, you know, 2% sounds pretty good, sounds like it's a minimal risk, but actually some of those ecosystems included in that 2% are among the most diverse on the planet, so places like coral reefs. So because of the emissions that we've already released, because of the warming that's essentially already built into the climate, we will unfortunately continue to see these kinds of impacts that we're seeing today on the coral reef ecosystem. The key message from our paper is we actually do still have time to really determine the fate of biodiversity over this century, and reducing our emissions, getting below 2 degrees C, can really avert risks across many thousands of species and across the majority of the Earth's surface.
Well, suppose we do slash emissions, a kind of stay-at-home therapy for the atmosphere and renewable energy. We give the plants, animals, insects, and all extra decades. Is there science to say that species can adapt to much higher temperatures in decades, or do they really need thousands or millions of years to make that change?
So I think part of this is about can species adapt. There is some evidence, and this is a really hot topic at the moment, is, you know, how long do species need to adapt? And I think that very much depends on the species that you're looking at. If you're looking at a bird or a mammal, which might have a generation length of a number of years, then really we're just talking about a few generations before these species are exposed to these dangerous climates. And yes, it seems unlikely that that's going to be long enough for them to adapt. So I think the idea that biodiversity can evolve out of this problem is unrealistic. Regardless of what we do, the climate is warming very rapidly, and I don't believe that species will be able to evolve enough to escape this problem. But I think another important aspect of this is the amount of time that it gives us to adapt to the changes. So having a few extra decades before a particular region is exposed to these dangerous climate conditions can provide a lot of time for the human societies that live in those regions and that depend on them to adapt. So throughout the tropics, hundreds of millions of people depend on local ecosystems such as coral reefs for their livelihoods or for their sources of protein. And we really need to buy these communities more time to adapt to these changing conditions. It also gives us more time to develop and improve our conservation strategies, to expand our network of protected areas, to potentially assist species in evolving, to assist species in moving to new areas where the climate might remain suitable. So I think the more time we have, I think the better our chances of being able to safeguard the majority of biodiversity through to the end of the century.
I think a lot of people would like to take this warning seriously, and it got very good coverage, and you and your team did a very excellent job of making the paper and data available in various formats for everyone. But I think most people are going to say, well, that does sound serious. I'll put it on the back burner, and if we get through this emergency, we'll deal with it. But my fear is it could take a couple of years to get through this coronavirus thing, and meanwhile, that's a couple of years where the species are more and more at risk. We don't have time. We're going to have to do both at once, I think.
I think it's very clear that we have to act now. There is no time to delay in terms of reducing our emissions. This is certainly something that we really have to be making huge strides to reduce our emissions and to do this in a very rapid way.
From the University College London, you operate the Piggott Lab. What are you working on now and what science do you look forward to?
So in our lab, we're generally interested in biodiversity. So we're interested in why biodiversity is distributed across the world in the way it is. Why, for instance, are most species living in the tropics? And we're interested in the impacts that biodiversity has on the functioning of ecosystems. So, for example, are there limits to how many species you can remove from an ecosystem before it collapses? And that obviously has important connections with this work that we're doing on climate change. And the other thing that we're really interested in is trying to push forward this work that we're doing, projecting how the risks to biodiversity might change over the coming decades. One of the things that I mentioned earlier is that all of these projections that we've made are based on the thermal limits of the species as we observe them today. Increasingly, with these events like coral bleaching and these die-off events, we're actually seeing these temporary excursions of temperature to much higher levels. And this is impacting on species causing local extinctions. So one of the things we're really interested in is to use these current impacts of climate change to then develop more refined projections of how biodiversity might change into the future.
We've been speaking with Dr. Alex Piggott. Don't miss learning about this new article in the journal Nature. The title is The Projected Timing of Abrupt Ecological Disruption from Climate Change. You can find links to the free paper, the Nature Commentary, which was very helpful by Dr. Sunday, and other popular press coverage, all in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Alex, thank you for explaining this serious new warning from science.
Thank you for having me on, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
The outcome of the CAPS pandemic in Event 201 was catastrophic. 65 million people died in the first 18 months. The outbreak was small at first and initially seemed controllable, but then it started spreading in densely crowded and impoverished neighborhoods of megacities. From that point on, the spread of the disease was explosive. Within 6 months, cases were occurring in nearly every country. The global economy was in a free fall. The GDP down 11%. Stock markets around the world plummeted between 20 and 40% and headed into a downward cycle of fear and low expectation. Businesses were not borrowing, banks were not lending. Everyone was just hoping to hunker down and weather the storm. Economists say the economic turmoil caused by such a pandemic will last for years, perhaps a decade. the societal impacts, the loss of faith in government, the distrust of news, and the breakdown of social cohesion could last even longer. We have to ask, did this need to be so bad? Are there things we could have done in the 5 to 10 years leading up to the pandemic that would have lessened the catastrophic consequences? We believe the answer is yes. So are we as a global community now finally ready to do the hard work needed to prepare for the next pandemic?
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Last week, while people huddled in their homes to slow the pandemic, a string of strange and strong tornadoes struck the American South, and wild storms knocked out power to about 1 million people in the Northeast. Extreme weather, hot oceans, and the coming heat waves tell us climate change has not self-isolated to fit the times. Now we have double anxiety, where even the safe and the dependable are suspect. We are literally out of touch with people we love. How can we grow out of that? Margaret Klein Salomon was a clinical psychologist in New York City. Then Hurricane Sandy struck. Life was not the same, and Margaret's journey took a big turn towards facing the climate threat. In June of 2015, I interviewed Margaret about the climate mobilization movement she organized. Since then, cities and countries unbelievably over the world have declared a climate emergency. Now Margaret has a timely new book out, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. Let's find out if that still works during the battle against coronavirus. Margaret Klein Salomon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Okay, so we have no ideas what emotions are developing in people shocked by the sudden shutdown of their lives that we all knew and so many deaths. Could these be the same emotions that come out when we realize our climate is in a frightening crisis as well?
In any kind of emergency situation like this that disrupts normal life in the present and calls the future into question, there's a range of emotions that we experience, and of course, all in a, you know, idiosyncratic and personalized way. But some key feelings that are widely shared are fear or terror, sadness, anger or rage, guilt or shame. These are really both coronavirus and the climate are overwhelming global issues that threaten lives and stability. So it makes sense that they bring up, you know, really the full spectrum of human emotion. But I think the two most important, most deserving of our attention and analysis are fear and grief.
As I have told you, this is one place where I slightly disagree with your book in the sense that I personally have not gone through a period of crying about the climate or deep grief. I've been heartbroken about some loss of species in the coral, and I'm worried, but in general, I feel more invigorated, like I just want to get going and do as much as I can about it.
The ultimate goal of my book is to move people into action, from pain into action. And if you can get there in one way and someone else gets it there a different way, then, you know, God bless. The critical thing is to be fighting to protect humanity and all life. Not everybody has to have the same experience. For many, let's say, the reckoning with the fact that the future is going to be dramatically different from the present, that the industrialized, globalized, consumerist world that we live in is in its last gasp, and our options are transform or collapse, and that we're headed straight for collapse. Those kinds of realizations can devastate people looking at climate truth, and to really integrate them, to really feel them and take them seriously and give them the attention that they deserve, that reality. The emotional process of grieving and really feeling the losses, both of human life, non-human life, and again, the future, our hopes and dreams and plans, I think for many is best described as a grieving process.
What is the state of mental health in America in general? Can you give us any of the stats?
Mental health in the United States could be better, let's say, where this concept of deaths of despair are on the rise, and that includes suicide, opiate, deaths where people have lost their motivation and their hope and their mission in life. So, yeah, 1 in 6 Americans take psychiatric medications. Opioids kill more Americans than car crashes. The average American watches 33 hours of TV a week, and I imagine that that would be even higher during this self-isolation time. So it can be hard to take a snapshot of a country's mental health, right? Obviously, some people are doing better than others and so forth, but I think broadly speaking, we are stressed, we are anxious, we are depressed, and we are dissociating in front of screens.
Now, many years ago, I read the work of psychoanalyst and anti-nuclear activist Eric Fromm. Could you talk to us about his view of what Sigmund Freud called the death instinct and how that applies to our situation and climate anxiety?
Yeah, Eric Fromm is an intellectual hero of mine and an activist hero. He played a really critical part in helping the United States and Soviet Union avoid nuclear war through, you know, psychological interpretation and helping both countries save face. Yeah, I'd always love to talk about Eric Fromm. And Eric Fromm's theory about loving life is so important. Eric Fromm said, most people have never met a healthy person. That achieving what he viewed as psychological health is actually very challenging, especially in a country that's so alienated and has so much advertising and, you know, just consumerism, competition, and so forth. It's very challenging to actually gain autonomy, morality, the feeling of empowerment to be able to make a difference in the world. And Eric Fromm said that if people feel disempowered, they feel like they can't create and nurture life or actively take part in the creation process of art or of, a company or an organization or, you know, making things happen in the world. If you can't be creative and engaged in life and feel good about yourself, then there is kind of a dark side of humanity, which he calls necrophilia, the love of death. So when people are frustrated and feel worthless and stuck and helpless, that they actually are okay with the fact or even seek destruction and collapse and decay because they already feel so badly inside that the idea of the world ending, it feels normal, natural, fitting. Eric Fromm wrote that he wrote an anti-nuclear paper, anti-nuclear weapons, that argued people need to love life. Because if they did, then we would never allow these weapons of mass destruction to threaten us all. And in the same way, I think that the bad feelings that people have about themselves and our society make it so when they hear, the climate is collapsing and there's going to be state failure and droughts and famines and horrible chaos, they think, all right, that's, it feels kind of normal to them because it is something similar to what they already feel inside.
Wow. Okay. So as a psychologist, you have a toolbox of ways people avoid dealing with their emotions and problems. Could you give us a couple of examples of the classic ways people avoid confronting the climate challenge?
So denial is the one we hear about the most. But that's only one kind of obvious defense. There's so many others, such as willful ignorance, which is one I personally used for many years. Willful ignorance is when you know enough to know that you don't want to know more. So I knew, ooh, this was bad. This makes me feel bad. It makes me feel anxious. So I'm just going to try and avoid it, right? Head in the sand. Intellectualization is another important one, which is where intellectually the person says, oh, yeah, I understand human fossil fuel use and industrial agriculture are warming the planet, and that's going to cause a ton of impacts. Like, I get it. But they keep it in the, like, science facts section of their mind and soul rather than really confronting and reckoning with what those facts mean on a deeply personal level. So, yeah, separating out the intellectual from the emotional, which is a kind of denial. I think a lot of, say, policy wonk types are in this camp that there's intellectual recognition but emotional denial. Dissociation, I mentioned, I think is an extremely common defense in the United States that involves zoning out. So often with the assistance of screens or alcohol, drugs, shopping, eating, other compulsive behaviors. So just, you know, a kind of anesthetizing and distraction.
As you note in your book, some big environmental organizations downplay the negative. They call us out as alarmists or doomers. Even climate groups have failed to communicate the full truth, saying, well, the public can't handle that. You can't frighten people. But then, Margaret, what happens when the gradualist approach, and it turns out climate change is not gradual at all?
Right. What you have just identified, what I consider the worst idea in the world, which is, as you said, actually quite popular still, even today, though it is being effectively challenged. But in the gradualist climate movement, there is an idea that, quote, fear doesn't work as a motivator, so we can't tell people the whole truth. And people such as yourself and myself and the climate mobilization that do tell the truth, that we are on the precipice of the collapse of civilization, as you said, are labeled alarmists rather than the fact that the situation is alarming. It's not, I'm sorry that people feel afraid. I understand that that might not be pleasant, but do you want to look at reality or not? Yeah, I think that has totally devastated the efficacy of the climate movement and frankly, in many ways, set us back. The public, if environmental NGOs are broadcasting the message that things are basically fine and can be handled over the course of decades, why on earth would the public believe that the problem is worse than that, which it is? So the idea that fear doesn't work as a motivator is very negatively affecting the political situation, and it is also just laughably wrong in that fear is the most basic motivator for humans and for other animals. Fear is literally the mechanism through which we translate a perception of a risk, of a danger, into self-protective action. If our ancestors didn't feel afraid, they would have just stood there as predators got closer and closer and then took a bite, right? Fear is a self-protective mechanism, and by attempting to short-circuit it in ourselves or in the public, we put ourselves in terrible danger.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I also liked in your new book, Facing the Climate Emergency, you give the example of being at work when a fire alarm goes off and we don't see any fire or smell the smoke. Is it real or is it a false alarm? And our action may depend on how others react. So climate change can be here among us before we experience all the symptoms. And that sounds so like COVID-19, don't you think?
Absolutely. The public is getting a taste of what an exponential emergency looks like, and the fact that you must take dramatic action before the crisis is upon you, because by the time that it's all the way there, you have already lost.
Everything's changing so fast, it is hard to imagine what climate activism during and after this pandemic will look like. And I see this going on for a year or two. What do you see?
On one hand, this is a devastating turn of events for the climate movement. For example, the Earth Day, 50th anniversary of Earth Day is coming up next week. And the youth climate strikers had been planning a 3-day strike, which I believe would have been the largest ever climate demonstrations in world history. So losing that and their, you know, the general cores of organizing small in-person meetings in homes or churches or libraries, in-person protests and direct action, you know, these are true losses to our ability to effectively organize. However, there are real opportunities and, opportunities for the climate movement as well, such as you noted, the parallels between COVID-19 and the climate emergency are very real, pretty clear, and already affecting public consciousness, such as, you know, the how do you pay for it argument that we hear over and over and over again about climate policies like the Green New Deal. And when the public and the media and the government are all in agreement that this is an existential crisis, then everything changes. And suddenly, we can afford dramatic action. So that's one thing, seeing how an emergency situation frees up funding, seeing countries around the world take radical measures to reorient their economy, such as Spain nationalizing their private hospitals. In France, perfume manufacturers started making disinfectant, and EM is making ventilators. So seeing how industrial mobilization on a smaller scale, but seeing how that works and why in an emergency it must happen. We are learning lessons in real time from the COVID epidemic. And back to Eric Fromm, I think perhaps the most important thing that I'm seeing, and I'm actually so happy to see, is the collective understanding that life is more important than money, and that, you know, some of the GOP and Trump wanted to reopen the economy, you know, yesterday by Easter. And we didn't do that because we wanted to protect human life. And I have been so relieved and happy to see that, because after 6 years of working on the climate emergency, I had started to fear that the necrophilic drives in humanity were ascendant and that we just weren't committed to protecting ourselves and each other. But with this emergency, I'm seeing that there really is still a collective desire to live and to protect life.
Now, you come at this with a psychological lens because of your training, and that's a great thing. But, you know, billions of people in India and China have never heard of Freud or Western psychology, and half the world's population is under the age of 30, so they don't have much connection or social memory of World War II mobilization. It makes me worry, is the climate mobilization a middle-class Western thing?
I think to a significant degree you are correct. I hope that it is a message that can reach beyond. I hope my book has a message that can reach beyond my milieu. I hope the climate mobilization has a message that can reach beyond the United States and middle class, but I'm not sure. To some degree it does, but I'm not sure how much. But I do think that the United States has a critical role. Historically, we're the world's largest emitter and still the world's richest country, though obviously that wealth is extremely concentrated. We have the world's largest military. There's just all of these ways that if we can succeed in moving the United States, I think we can also move the world, though not necessarily with the same narrative.
With so many people stuck at home, at least for those that have a home, they maybe have time now to educate themselves on climate change and time to imagine a future we want and that we don't want and to plan our action. How can your new book help with that? And is there a Kindle version online if people can't get to closed bookstores?
Yeah, thank you so much. I really do hope that people use this time to reflect, to think about the big picture, to grieve. And, of course, I would be honored if my book could be a part of that. So readers can pre-order the book or access a one-chapter free preview at facingtheclimateemergency.com. And it's also available on Amazon and other bookstores or book ordering websites.
Now, the UN advises putting climate on the back burner, their words. Margaret, what do you think?
I think that that is a mistake. I think that the coronavirus, while truly frightening and a real crisis, is a tiny fraction of what we are in for with the climate emergency. And while I understand that people are afraid of the coronavirus now, and I mean, me too, definitely, no one wants to get that virus, we are on a collision course with the collapse of civilization. And this is not in the distant future. I personally do not expect to die of natural causes in old age. I expect to die from the chaos and breakdown that the climate emergency is sowing. And I so wish that that wasn't true, but it's not a reality that we can afford to forget, even when we're facing another crisis.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Now, all industrialized countries have slashed emissions like never before. There are no gas-guzzling cars on many roads, and some coal-powered factories are shut down. Do you see here, when we talk about reopening the economy, do you see an opportunity to open it selectively, not to recover the former destructive normal, but getting places powered by renewable energy and producing products that are really in tune with the natural world? It seems like a really good chance.
I agree with that. Why reopen parts of the economy that are not essential and killing us? Let's use this as an opportunity to transition to something regenerative.
Talk to us about Genevieve Gunther and what she does.
Genevieve Gunther is a literature professor who has her insight and skills at analyzing language and narrative to analyze how climate is covered or not covered in the media. And she launched a project called Ending Climate Silence, which basically, I mean, they do more than this, but the heart of it is just calling out journalists on Twitter and editors and publications for reporting on stories that absolutely have a climate angle, a critical climate angle, but they leave it out. So she is not calling for more standalone stories on climate, though I'm sure she would love that. But she is calling for including the climate story in stories about, for example, drought or fires or food prices or refugees from Latin America to the U.S. I mean, these stories that are climate stories, but the media has done an absolutely terrible job of recognizing them as such. So she is calling these media sources out and also helping them to fix their error and include the climate information that needs to be included for responsible reporting.
Margaret, in a way, you go further than I do. You want to go beyond communicating about the climate, but to actually solve the climate crisis. And I don't pretend I can do that, but I do hope some of my listeners can. Would you tell us about your organization's Victory Plan?
The Victory Plan was written by Ezra Silk in 2016. It is our 100-page answer to the question that we got over and over again. What do you mean World War II-scale climate mobilization? So the Victory Plan lays out, sector by sector, how a emergency speed transition to zero and negative emissions could be accomplished if you remove the barriers of political intransigence and denial that are currently swamping our political conversation on climate. So if the country entered emergency mode on climate, like we are on coronavirus, but even more so because it's an even worse problem, what could be possible? So we advocate policies in the Victory Plan, such as an immediate ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure, no new refineries, no new export terminals, and a early retirement of our existing fossil fuel capacity so that we would shut, gradually phase out all fossil fuel use by 2030. We call for a ban on factory farms and a 5-year transition off pesticides. We call for a huge investment in renewable energy and public transportation and an immediate change to an all-electric vehicle standard, so no producing vehicles with internal combustion engines anymore. Calls for carbon farming and regenerative agriculture that binds carbon into the soil and also food security. We call for a massive energy conservation project, which includes like insulating every home, and we call for building a super smart grid. It's incredibly ambitious and shows that we could solve these problems. We have the political technical tools that we need. What we don't have is the political will.
As we wrap up here, Margaret, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
As you mentioned, the climate mobilization has been one of the pioneers of the Climate Emergency Declaration Campaign, which has won more than 1,400 governments declaring a climate emergency. We're always looking for more organizers and organizations to join that work. So if you're interested, come to theclimatemobilization.org and join in.
We've been speaking with the founder of the Climate Mobilization, Margaret Klein Salomon. Find her new book, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth, at New Society Publishers or anywhere books are sold online. Margaret, you really are a power in your own right. You have made some big changes. Thank you for talking with us again.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In the sad passion play that pretends to be an American federal government, President Trump is stumbling backward into the right idea for once, sort of. As reported by Bloomberg News on April 15, Trump's administration is proposing to pay U.S. oil producers to leave it in the ground. That is exactly the slogan and goal of environmentalists around the world. We cannot burn all the oil, gas, and coal we have. If we do, the world will warm past the limits of continuing civilization. It will wipe out entire chains of species, killing off millions of humans. We have to leave it in the ground, that's for sure. Trying to stave off inevitable bankruptcy in the mostly Republican American oil and gas industry, Trump wants to buy up to 365 million barrels of crude oil, ostensibly for the Strategic Reserve. The U.S. taxpayers would hand more billions to the wealthiest companies and families on Earth for their deadly product. No doubt the surviving Koch brothers would get another big piece of the pie. The trouble is, there is no place to store the glut of unused oil and gas we already have. There are super tankers full of oil out in the ocean and nowhere to sell it. Some companies are leasing ships as portable storage. So the Trump gang go the next step. The U.S. Treasury, which means American taxpayers, by the way, would buy the oil in advance, giving companies more billions for nothing, and keep an IOU of oil for another time. Just leave it in the ground, they say. Has Trump gone over to the green side? Hardly. It's just a giveaway to his buddies, and the government still hopes to burn all that oil and heat the planet as soon as possible, as soon as we can get back to business as usual. But the harsh news is, normal is not coming back. For example, a new paper published in the journal Science on April 14 suggests not only recurring waves of COVID-19, but a need to keep social distancing and other prophylactic protections until the year 2022, a full 2 years. Even then, if a vaccine is not found, and that's not guaranteed, this threat may be with us for a decade or longer. The paper is titled Projecting the Transmission Dynamics of SARS-CoV-2 Through the Post-Pandemic Period. Governments in various countries, including Australia and to some degree Canada, are beginning to let out the word, we may need a modified lockdown for at least a year. This is no time for magical thinking. The whole meme of, when will we reopen, is a cruel distraction. Governments and media should instead be directing attention to three things. Immediate health care, where clusters and hotspots spring up, keep people alive. Second, keep the food supply chain going. And third, the climate emergency action to create a low-emission economy that works for all citizens, not just the billionaires at the top. None of that is unrealistic, and none of it is optional. Truly unrealistic is a desire to go back into the past, to an economy that wrecks the world and tears down the future. That's what we had. It was bound to crash or go down in flames sooner or later. Going out shopping for entertainment, burning fossil fuels without limit, whee, let's drive across the country and see what's going on, like it's a birthright. That has to be over, at least until we have electric cars and a responsible energy system. This is a time to appreciate real essentials, an appreciation for all living things, an understanding of our small role in the web of life, and humility in our demands on natural systems. It is a huge, wrenching change for all of us, but we are going to be happier because of it. We are not consumers. We were not born to buy things. We are participants in a complex planet, one species among the many. And it's marvelous. I don't care for preachy people. Radio EcoShock keeps going for the voices of scientists and the activists who cherish facts and real action. I don't know where all this is going any more than you do. But we can all see that any attempt to return to the fossil-powered miracle with unlimited humans on a small planet is a death wish. That's what most governments, the former big business and banks, and corporate media are selling you now. Let's go back to shooting crack, inventing money for the few, and teetering on the edge of high rooftops. What could go wrong? It's the wrong conversation for where we are and our limited possibilities ahead. Dig in, folks. This could be the Great Depression. And it could be the beginning of a new society worth living in. A civilization that plans to live beyond the next quarter, the next decade, and the next century. Don't be fooled by regressive daydreams and inferior products. Dream big and start small. Here on my homestead lot in the village, I have new friends for the quarantine. My chickens arrived today. We have potatoes growing in buckets and plants in every window, ready for the new spring. I don't know what kind of co-op or telephone neighbor support network you can build where you are. I don't know what really useful role you can play, but I think you do. I think you can find out. You can figure it out. I know you can start something small and local to make lives better. Meanwhile, please play it safe, and we can make something real and new. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week on Radio EcoShock.